Well, many thanks for your kind introduction. I think you have very insightfully contextualized the question which I will be dealing with. I must say that I'm very happy to be back here because the last time I attended one of these famous Friday's lunches was 12 years ago. And actually, I would like to start with an anecdote dating back to that time. I remember enjoying these lunches very much, not only because they were free sandwiches, but also because you would always gain something from the lecture. However, there was one thing which really terrified me 12 years ago when I was sitting there. It was just situations where there would be no questions from the audience. And I remember then that James would then pick up somebody in the audience. That was terrifying. I was a young student at that time. It was terrifying. Fortunately, James would always pick up the he had always the same victims, which at that time were Roger O'Keefe, my friends and colleagues, Roger O'Keefe and Christian Tams, which were young PhDs, and they would usually be the culprits and the victims of James' arbitrary pickup. Well, having said that, I just hope to make today a thought-provoking and a provocative argument to make sure that at least everyone in the room has a remark to formulate or as a question. And why is my argument provocative? Well, precisely for the reasons mentioned by Professor Allot. I think that the argument which I've developed in this book, sorry for the self-promotion, actually the argument in this book comes to challenge the way in which we construe the sources, the theory of the sources of international law. And this is a very sensitive issue because in the European tradition of international law, sources, the theory of sources occupies a very central place. It is a cornerstone of how we actually identify, how we ascertain, how we cognize and how we interpret and how we apply international law. Now, all these operations that the international lawyers does actually rest in a way or another on the theory of sources. So the question I'm dealing with here is very determinative of how we understand international as a whole, and I appreciate that this makes it a very sensitive debate. The argument in the book goes as follows. The argument, which is actually a very simple and non-sophisticated argument, the argument is, well, we need a theory of sources, and we need a formal theory of sources, because only a formal theory of sources allows us to and enables us to ascertain the rules of international law. In the sense that we need formal indicators, we need formal yardsticks to determine actually the pedigree of the rules and so to be able to identify the rules of international law. So we need formalism. Well, the second part of the argument is that we need formalism, but not in the form of the current theory of sources, which I believe is highly deficient. So the book and the argument takes aim at the current theory of sources, and usually that creates some unease, especially among European international lawyers. The argument is, of course, also very provocative to an American audience, but probably for different reasons, simply because in the US, after a century after legal realism, and well, the plea for formalism is in itself very, very provocative and very idiosyncratic. And simply because, and that's something to which I will revert later on, in the US, we witness a radical move away from the theory of sources. So it's also a very provocative argument in the eyes of American legal scholars, but for different reasons. Well, my intention for the following 20 or 25 minutes, or longer, or even better, my intention for the following 40 minutes maybe is actually just to sketch out the argument, actually even to spell it out a little bit, and to show how we need, and then actually to show how we need and why we need to refresh a little bit the understanding of the theory of sources. That will be the first part of my talk. The second part will pertain rather to a description. I will try to describe and depict the context, the epistemic context of the argument, and I will try to put it a little bit into perspective. Why do we need to make this argument today? So that will be the second part. Well, the argument, I've already briefly sketched out the argument. Let me elaborate a little bit on this. So the argument is premised on the idea that something Poncelet had already alluded to, that we live at least with the perception that the world and that the international society is growing more complex, and this complexification is actually accompanied by a complexification of the exercise of public authority at the international level. Public authority at the international level is no longer exclusively exercised in the form of treaty making. But there are new ways and informal ways to make standards binding standards, which are meant to actually curtail the freedom of action of international actors. And so there is a great complexification of standard making at the international level, which does not necessarily take the form of hard international law. And precisely because we witness this complexification of international norm making, we need even more than before formal signposts, formal indicators that will allow us to delineate international law and to distinguish law from non-law. And I believe these formal indicators must take the form of a formal theory of sources, and the theories of sources being in this sense meant to provide to determine, to define the pedigree of the rules of the international legal system. Well, as you probably all know, well, a theory of sources is never self-standing. It needs to be anchored in something, and that's the old, that's a debate as old as legal theory. It's the whole question. Once you make a plea for a theory of sources, the whole question is precisely how do you anchor, how do you make it, how do you anchor it in solid foundations, huh? And that's the second part of the argument, which is that actually the theory of sources must be must rest on what I call, it doesn't come from me, what I call some social practice. Simply because the theory of sources manifests itself through ordinary language. What I mean by that is that the way we define the criteria to determine international law, to identify international laws, actually are defined, these criteria are themselves formulated with ordinary language. Well, it's a bit mundane what I'm saying is very mundane. This ordinary language is indeterminate. There is no meaning per se. We have moved away from Aristotle. We live in the era of Wittgenstein. I think it's no longer contested. The indeterminacy of language is no longer contested. And that's why the theory of sources, which is formulated in ordinary language, needs to rest on some, I believe, external foundations. External foundations. Of course, you know the debate, you know that Kelsen tried to actually ensure the autonomy of the system and the theory of the system and try to make it completely autonomous from external elements. I believe that this cannot be achieved, and that the theory of sources needs to be cannot be postulated. It cannot be postulated, and it needs to be anchored in something else. And this something else is what I believe is the social practice of international judges, as well as other law-applying authorities. It's simply, what I mean by that is that, so the theory of sources is indeterminate. The meaning thereof will come, needs to be inferred from what I call the social practice, that is, the practice of law ascertainment, practice of law identification of international courts and tribunal, domestic courts and tribunal, and, I believe, other, also the practice of other actors. This practice of actors is what actually will generate the semantics that give meaning to the theory of sources. And this is what also makes it a very dynamic theory of sources, because that means that the theory of sources is evolutive. It evolves with the practice of the law-applying authorities. That also means that new sources may arise if the practice generates these new criteria to identify the law. And that also means that we can actually, the practice can generate criteria that allows the capture, the apprehension of these new normative phenomena, and these new exercises of public authority at the international level. Well, again, I don't believe that all this is very sophisticated. And likewise, this is nothing groundbreaking. This is nothing new. We owe this argument to English analytical jurisprudence, and in particular Herbert Hart, even though I believe that this conception of the theory of sources is something which was already devised by Salmond, a New Zealander, which is probably one of the most underrated and overlooked scholars. And it's very interesting that actually Hart, I mean, this theory is what we call the social thesis, and the idea that the meaning of the secondary rules come from the practice of law-applying authorities. This is what we call in legal theory the social thesis. Well, the social thesis was not, in my view, not invented by Hart. It was more a creation of Salmond, and it's very interesting to note that Hart barely acknowledged it's the legacy of Salmond. I think in the entire work of Hart, there's only one footnote to Salmond. Hart rather said that his social thesis was coming from Wittgenstein and from the philosophy of language, but this is a point which is very much disputed in legal theory, and I don't want to elaborate on this here. What I'm saying is that I believe that grounding the theory of sources in social practice is what allows us to refresh our understanding of the sources, and what allows us to make sense of international law in an era of great complexification of the exercise of public authority at the international level. Having said that, I'm not claiming that we should transpose harsh and positivism to international law. That would create many, many problems. Well, maybe that's something on which we can revert in the discussion. But radical harsh and positivism create huge problems. Not because, as Hart himself said, that there is no secondary rules in international law. Rather, it's because hard positivism required some social conscience by law applying authorities, and you can make the argument that international law, actually international legal, international law applying authorities, international judges, do not have this social conscience that is needed for the legal system to exist. But we may come back to that. What I mean is that this idea of a social thesis, that is the idea that the theory of sources is grounded in the practice of courts and tribunal, is actually something. The social thesis is what creates the possibility of formalism and the possibility of formal criteria to identify the law. And the upsides and the advantage of this is, as I've already said, it allows us to have an evolutive and dynamic theory of sources. It allows the theory of sources actually to move away from intent, and I think it's very important to emphasize here that such a conception or social conception of the theory of sources should not be conflated with state centricism and voluntarism. On the contrary, it allows the system to move away from state centricism. It is also a conceptualization of the sources which can accommodate new forms of law of norm making, and above all, I believe it's also a conceptualization that allows us to bypass this abiding question of the foundation of the international legal order. We don't need to seek a foundation for the theory of sources or for the secondary rules. You don't need a Grundnorm. No. You just, because the foundation is simply a social fact. It is a fact. It is a practice of courts and tribunals. It is, so the foundation becomes a fact. International law becomes a fact. The foundation of international law is a fact. And that fact is the idea that there are courts and tribunals that do apply a theory of sources. And so it allows you to bypass these abiding questions of the foundation of the international legal system. And this is, I believe, the added value of the social thesis compared to more to Kelsenian positivist position on the matter. Well, that is, in a nutshell, the argument. Again, not very sophisticated. However, I think I still need to make two caveats at this point. The first one is that, so I'm saying we need some formalism to determine. Criteria whereby international law is ascertained. Well, I'm just talking about law identification. I'm not talking about content determination. And here I would really like to emphasize the necessity to distinguish between law ascertainment, law identification, and content determination. I don't believe, and I still, and this sounds very legal realist. This is an old argument that was formulated by the legal realists in the beginning of the 20th century. But I don't think that formalism is very helpful when it comes to determining the content of international rules. Formalism is, and that's why the argument is actually very restricted, and has a very restricted ambit. Formalism is only helpful when it comes to determine. To identify the law. So we're not talking here about content determination. I think content determination is something that it's a matter of interpretation. And we know that many international scholars have tried to somehow disregarding the major charge, or the very compelling objections of legal realists. International legal scholars keep on trying to formalize the theory of interpretation. And they keep on trying to formalize the way the content is determined. This is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about formalism in the identification of rules, not formalism with respect to the content determination, the determination of the content of rules. That was my first caveat. Second caveat, I want to emphasize that this approach to the sources of international law is not meant to explain the whole phenomenon of law. Law is much more than a set of rules. Law is many more. Law is also a process. It's a very intricate process. Well, so that's why the formalism, as I construe it here, is actually has very limited explanatory virtues. It has very limited explanatory virtues. It doesn't explain and doesn't shed light on the whole phenomenon of law. It's very restricted, and has a very restricted ambit. It has a very restricted ambit and a very restricted function, which is the identification of rules. Full stop. So in that sense, it's very reductionist. And it's also, I would dare to say, ecumenical. It is ecumenical in the sense that it needs such a conception of formalism, needs other approaches to international law to explain the other dimensions of law. So in that sense, it is not exclusive of other approaches, for instance, process-based approaches to law. Critical approaches and so on. It is just restricted to the identification of rules, which, this being said, remains a very crucial operation because once again, we need for different reasons and at some given moment we need a snapshot of the rules. Just if we want to apply them at a given time, you need a snapshot of the rules at that moment. And the same if you want to evaluate or criticize a rule, you need to ascertain them. This being said, that shows that the outcome or the product of such a formal theory of sources is static in itself. It is geared towards giving a static snapshot of the rules. However, the theory itself is evolutive. And dynamic. It can change with the practice. And that was the second caveat I wanted to make. So the explanatory virtues are very limited. Right? It's not meant to explain the whole phenomenon of law. So this is the argument. Rather simple so far. And you may wonder at this stage, why do we need to make this argument? Why is it topical? Is it a timely argument? Well, and this brings me to my second point, which is a little bit the epistemic background of that debate. And I would like to here to start by saying how much we are now in an age of deformalization. The making of norms is growing more, is being deformalized. We use less formal instruments to set the standards that are meant to regulate the conduct of international actors. But the way we identify the law, the way the profession that studies international law, that is us, more and more we are inclined to actually resort to non-formal criteria to identify the rules. And actually I'm even claiming that what we witness today in European, would say, in the science of international law, something you could not say in the US, that in the international legal scholarship, we witness a radical move away from a formal theory of sources. There is a move away from formal techniques of identification of law. And I would like now to give you just a few examples of this deformalization which is witnessed in the international, in the literature and in the science of international law. And I'll give you just a very brief mapping of the different types of deformalization which I believe are currently witnessed in the legal scholarship. I'll give you three groups of scholars who actually advocate the resort to non-formal criteria to identify law. And probably the most common of them, the first group, the most common, is actually made of these scholars that resort to what I call impact-based techniques of identification. And that is the idea that the law, that international law, is identified on the basis of, by virtue of, its impact. And then you have a growing number of scholars, especially in the United States, that do argue that actually anything, any standard that has an impact on an international actor should be elevated into international law. I mean, I don't know if you take the work, for instance, of Alvarez or people like that, or even the liberal school of international law in the U.S., you have many people saying that we should consider international law anything that has an impact on international actors. And you see that behind it, there is the deformalization is twofold. We use the criterion of impact, and we use the criterion of actors, and none of them are formally defined. So there is a twofold deformalization behind this approach. And it's not entirely new. I mean, I believe the whole theory of soft law is actually inspired by this. It is the result. Soft law is based on a non-formal criterion of law identification. Law is no longer identified on the basis of a formal criterion. And very often these impact-based approaches to law identification are geared towards the expansion of international law. The idea is to expand international law and to elevate into law standards which otherwise would be left aside. That's a first group of scholars. You have a second group, which usually are which is associated with neorealism in the U.S. and in international relations. It is the compliance-based approaches to law identification, and that is the idea that law is what states comply with, and that's Polsner, Goldsmith, and so on. So there you see that the criterion for law identification is compliance. Is international law complied with? So compliance then becomes the criterion through which, or by virtue of which, you identify international law. So that's the second group of scholars. The third one is probably more known, and that is the group of scholars made of who argue that law is a process. These are the process-based approaches to international law, and nothing new. We all remember the New Haven Law School, McDougall. And others and associates, that is the idea that law is a continuum. Well, that's the problem. The law is a continuum. It starts somewhere. It ends somewhere. Actually, we don't know, and we don't need to know. We don't need to identify the rule. Law is a process. It's a continuum. But that's the most radical form of deformalization, because there, actually, you don't need law as a thing. You don't need to identify the rules. Law is a process. Well, three groups of scholars who actually manifest, I mean, these are just three examples that manifest this move away from formal criteria of law identification. Of course, I should say a word about critical legal studies, which is a little bit the elephant in the room. Well, critical legal studies as such has not been advocating a move away from formalism in law identification. And if you take the work of Marty on the culture of formalism, of course, it was meant as being ironical, but this conception of the culture of formalism, I think, by virtue of that idea, I think Marty shows that he believes that some sort of formalism should be preserved. of course, in a way radically different from what I'm advocating in the book. So critical legal studies as such has never, in my view, in my interpretation, has never been advocating a radical move away from formal law identification. This, having said that, they have raised very compelling charges against formalism, but for other reasons. So there are quite a lot of scholars so being tempted by this deformalization of our law identification techniques, and this usually manifests itself by an abandonment of the theory of sources, and this is something which is noticeable, especially in American legal scholarship. Why such a success of deformalization? Why are so many scholars tempted by this move away from the theory of sources? Well, of course, there are various reasons. There is there is a multiple agenda behind it. The first one, I've already alluded to that, it's the expansion of international law. It's the idea that through deformalization, we try to capture in law things with standards of conduct which otherwise would have remained outside the ambit of law. And this is informed by this common idea that law is necessarily good and that we need to expand it. Well, there's also another agenda, which is the expansion of the object of study of the international legal scholarship. Through deformalization, you can elevate into objects of studies topics which otherwise would have been left to other social sciences. And I mean, that's an argument I made several years ago with respect to softness. Softness, I believe, is a technique of the legal scholarship to create new legal materials of study. And I think that's one of the reasons and one of the driving forces of the deformalization of the techniques of identification of law. There are other reasons. Accountability is usually invoked. People say that we need to create an accountability mechanism for these new forms of exercises of public authority, and the idea is that we need to make them lawmaking, proper lawmaking processes, so that they would fall within the ambit of the accountability mechanisms of international law. To be honest, I'm not entirely convinced by that argument, because it's slightly paradoxical to try to apprehend these phenomena which are outside the law for accountability related purposes, simply because I believe when it comes to accountability, international law is very poor. I think the accountability mechanisms provided by international law are extremely poor and underdeveloped, and I don't think that by bringing these exercises of public authority within the scope of international law, you would necessarily generate accountability mechanisms for these exercises of public authority. Another reason is that's probably as old as international litigation. It's what I would call adjudicative creativity. I mean, counsels in cases, we are very often tempted by or often resort to techniques of law identification which are non-formal, simply because that allows them to find legal underpinnings for a claim which otherwise they couldn't make. And eventually there's this bit of a buzzword nowadays. It is this idea of legal pluralism. And the formalism, because it generates formal unity, it is seen as deeply anti-pluralistic. And this idea of legal pluralism has been reinforcing for bad reasons, because I sincerely believe that legal pluralism and formalism are not incompatible. But this idea of legal pluralism has been reinforcing the move away from formal theory of sources. So this is the background of the argument. This is the background of the argument, and this is why I believe this is why I felt necessary to make such a plea for formal theory of sources. And it's a retreat from the theory of sources, which is especially noticeable in the American legal scholarship. Provided I still have the time, I don't know how we're I would like to actually say a word now to the current theory of sources. As I said, I think we need formalism in law identification, but I'm also saying that the current theory of sources in this respect is highly deficient and highly unsatisfactory. And I would like to give you two examples. I believe that actually, the current theory of sources is not formal. Very often, we portray the current theory of sources as a formal theory. I believe this is not the case. And I think the best example is the theory of customary international law. I think customary international law, the theory of customary international law, is the embodiment of non-formal techniques of law identification. I mean, we all know our basics. Huh? We know that customary law rests on practice, general practice, and opinion iuris. Well, these are two non-formal criteria. These are non-formal criteria. Practice is not a formal criteria. Opinion iuris is not a formal criteria. They're non-tangible. They're deeply speculative. They're non-criteria. We have tried to formalize them. We've tried. And you look at the textbooks, a super sophisticated theory on the two elements. Now, we have tried to formalize them. But eventually, at the end of the day, custom identification is a deformalized technique. It's a technique that actually it rests on non-formal criteria. It's true, we have tried to offset the non-formal character of custom identification by the idea that custom creation is not only a process, but it's also a procedure. And that is the idea behind the theory of the persistent objector, or the idea behind the modern customer, is the idea that there is a formal procedure that leads to the creation of custom. We've also tried to formalize the evidence of custom. And now many people argue that actually the two elements are just techniques to evidence the existence of custom. And in that sense, the theory of customary law is just a program for the evidence of custom. So we've tried to formalize custom, but at the end of the in different manners. But at the end of the day, custom identification is not a formal mechanism. The same argument can be made with respect to treaty identification. When it comes to treaties, as we all know, as we have been taught in the faculties all over the world, that, well, a treaty, as we know, is actually identified on the basis of the instrument, on the basis of the written treaty, and I'm talking here about written treaty. So at face value, treaty identification is formal, right? Because what matters is actually, it is a written instrument that will indicate whether actually an agreement is a treaty or not. Right? And here we've not embraced this idea voiced by many people at Lauterbach that it is the content of the treaty that determines whether it's a treaty. No, the mainstream position is that it is the instrumentum, as we call it, and not the negotium, that determines whether an agreement is a treaty. However, as we also know, and as we are taught in this university, well, eventually, what you look at the treaty, you look at the formal instrument, but what matters, what is determinative, is actually the intent. So here, again, you fall back on a non-formal criterion. You fall back on a non-formal criterion, which is very problematic, as we all know, as we have, and judges have been confronted with the problems inherent in the law identification function of intent. We've tried to formalize it either on the basis of expressed intent or actual intent, but all this has remained deeply speculative. All this has remained deeply speculative, and actually that's why treaty identification is as an element, a non-formal element, which is quite dominant. And so that's why I believe the current theory of sources is, when it comes to formalism, very deficient. So it means that the resort to non-formal criteria of law identification have been with us for quite some time. And this theory of sources that has been devised in the early 20th century. Well, it has been with us for quite some time. And this inevitably raises the question of, but then, why should we bother? Why should we bother? We have been using non-formal mechanism of law identification for more than a century. Why shall we bother? Well, and that brings me to the point of the cost of the use of non-formal criteria of law identification. And I think these costs are very often underestimated. For instance, I believe there is a cost for the rules of international themselves. I believe that the use of non-formal techniques of law identification actually undermines and diminishes the authority and the normativity of international legal rules simply because they cannot be properly ascertained. There is a cost for the science of law. As long as we cannot properly ascertain the rules of international law, well, international legal scholarship boils down to nothing more than a cacophony. Right? And we have all scholars talking past each other. Right? And when you think about the cost for the society of the international legal scholarship, this raises quite a lot of questions. I mean, all these debates, but actually it's just cacophony, and because people simply don't agree on what the rules are. There's also a cost for the critique, for the possibility of a critique of law. How can you appraise the virtue, moral, economic, and so et cetera, of rules if you cannot ascertain, if you cannot identify them? And so it really undermines the possibility to of a critique of law. And it also undermines, for those of us or of you who think that the rule of law is a good thing, it also undermines the possibility of a rule of law at the international level, simply because the lack of proper law identification mechanism actually gives all the actors subject to the rule greater room of maneuver to bypass the rule. At this stage, probably, you might think that this is very much of a storm in a cup of tea, and especially the practitioners in the room may think, well, you seem to imply that there is a crisis of the sources of international law, but in the practice, in the adjudicative practice, where I haven't seen that. And it's true that practitioners would usually make the argument, well, I go to the court, and maybe that's the argument James would be making today, when I'm going to the court, well, I use the theory of sources, and there's no trust, no problem. And all this is actually, all this debate, it's all this problem may exist in the legal scholarship, but is entirely self-inflicted, self-created by some scholars. So practitioners could say, well, does that really matter from the standpoint of adjudicative practice? Is there really a crisis in adjudicative practice? Well, I acknowledge that this is primarily a theoretical and academic debate. However, I do believe as well that it impinges and it bears upon international, the practice of courts and tribunal, and that in some way or another it is already trickling down into the practice of courts and tribunal. And I think recent case law shows a really growing lack of interest of international courts in questions of law identification. And if you look at the case law of the International Court of Justice nowadays, it is very striking that the court no longer takes pain to explain the foundation of its theory of sources. And it's very striking when you compare it to the case law of the court in the 50s or in the 60s. Nowadays, the court is somehow afraid by this question. The court is really afraid by this question, and really they shy away from actually explaining the foundation of their theory of sources, and even they shy away from disclosing the criteria they use. And very often you take the Pope Mills recently, the court will say, well, this is an international agreement, period, without justifying how it reaches this conclusion. So that's why I don't think it's exclusively an academic debate, and I think it does bear upon the practice. Before concluding, I would like to make one final remark, just to avoid some misunderstanding. I'm quite critical of the current theory of sources, which I believe is deficient from the standpoint of formalism. In making that argument, I am not making a plea for the abandonment of the current theory of sources, simply because that would be entirely vain. The current theory of sources exists as a matter of fact. It exists as a matter of practice of international courts and tribunals. International courts and tribunals use the theory of customary international law, however deficient it might be. So I'm not saying we should abandon it, because simply I don't think the current theory will disappear. And we can just take the example of custom. Everybody is happy with this deficient theory of custom. Everybody. States, it offers states a great room of maneuver. It offers states flexibility. It offers greater freedom, despite the fact that they are subject to, they may be subject to rule of customary international law, but their room of maneuver is actually not as affected as we think it is. Some scholars are very happy with the theory of custom because it's an instrument that allows them to convey development, progressive development in the law. And custom is often used as a programmatic mechanism, right, to change the law and to create, to push for new rules of international law. And judges themselves are also great fan of the theory of custom. Custom is the best lawmaking tool for judges. So everybody is happy with the theory of custom, however deficient it may be. Not everyone, but a great deal of all those that use, study, and practice international law are quite happy with the theory of sources. And therefore, I don't think it will disappear in the near future. I don't think so. And however, what the argument I'm making is that we should cease from believing that the theory of sources is a formal theory of sources. I think we should just be honest, and we should just disclose the fact and come to terms with the fact that actually the current theory of sources rests on non-formal mechanism of law identification, and that this generates the problems I have mentioned. My final observation, very short. I'd like to say a word about actually, it's not self-promotion, about art, about art. It's about the piece of art which is on the cover of the book. It's actually a painting by Russian-born painters, Nicolas de Staël, who lived actually eventually lived in France, and actually it's meant to be a painting of a landscape. Actually, it's called Study of a Landscape. It comes from it's at the Tate Gallery. I really invite you to see the canvas at the Tate Gallery. Well, Nicolas de Staël, all his life, was torn by the tension between figurative painting and abstract painting. And during all his career, he oscillated between the two. And this, actually, you couldn't say whether it's figurative or abstract painting. Now you don't know. There is this ambiguity. And actually, all his life, he struggled with the question about how to make sense of reality with abstraction. And that's the fundamental question he actually fought and grappled with during in his work, and which is very reminiscent of the question we are dealing with, and which is very reminiscent of the question at the heart of the theory of sources, which is how to make sense of international law, how to assert, to identify international law through abstract formal criteria. This is the question at the heart of the theory, the debate about the theory of the sources. Well, in the case of Nicolas de Staël, I'm afraid to say that this led to suicide at the age of 54. Well, my book tries to show that suicide is not the only outcome of inquiries in the foundation of the theory of sources. The book tries to make the argument that when we inquire, when we research the foundation of the theory of sources, we're not condemned to radical indeterminacy and nihilism. Even though the book casts some shadow on the current theory of sources, I think the book also, if I may say, expresses a faith, which is the faith in the possibility to make sense of international law. Thank you very much.